Arsenal for Democracy is available twice a week. There's a free episode at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple or Stitcher each weekend, and a midweek bonus episode at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy, available for $5 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stunt Bird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California, New York Island, the Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 340, recorded on January 10th, 2021. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey, here in Newton, Massachusetts. Joining me on the line, as always, from Boise, Idaho, is my co-host, Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Glad to be here.
And joining me on the line from New York City is returning co-host, Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Rachel.
So this week, we're going to be talking about the Taft-Hartley Act, passed in 1947. This is something that we've, of course, alluded to frequently on the show, and we had talked several weeks ago on the show about the 1934 Toledo Auto Light strike, and we'll be talking about some more of those 1934 strikes. Those were happening in the context of two of the Great Depression era labor laws, one of which is known as the Wagner Act, which was passed subsequently to those events in 1934. And we are going to be talking about what those acts covered, what the Taft-Hartley Act replaced, and then subsequently what has happened since the passage of the Taft-Hartley Act. We will also be talking on future episodes about more state-level labor law issues and so forth, as well as recent applications of the Taft-Hartley Act of 1947. But this week, we're going to be focusing more directly on that legislation. As I said, that was passed in June 1947 by the new Republican Congress with substantial Democratic support over the objections of President Harry Truman following a previous year-and-a-half-long strike wave, which Kelly is going to be talking about, that followed World War II. It was sponsored on the House side by Congressman Fred A. Hartley Jr. of New Jersey, then in his final term after two decades, who had survived many close races during the height of the Democratic hegemony during the Depression and the war. He was later unsuccessful in seeking Senate seats for New Jersey, and it was, of course, famously sponsored on the Senate side by Ohio Senator Robert A. Taft, chair of the Senate Republican Policy Committee and the Senate Labor Committee, who was also the son of President Howard Taft. Robert Taft, who had been one of the most prominent anti-New Dealers since his election in 1938, would go on to unsuccessfully seek the GOP presidential nomination against Eisenhower in 1952. He had already, at this point in 1947, he had already sought the nomination in 1940. He did so again the next year in 1948, and he came the closest in 1952, but the more moderate war hero Eisenhower prevailed narrowly. Ironically, Taft would die of cancer the following year, so if he had become president, he would have died in office. Back in 1944, Taft had come within 18,000 votes of being unseated for re-election because of immense union opposition, but as we're going to talk about, they seemingly he beat them in the end with the Taft-Hartley Act. In his 1950 Senate campaign, he blew his opponent out of the water by more than 431,000 votes, exploiting fractures in both the Democratic Party and union membership that had emerged on the question of labor militancy and leftism. And you can go back to our episode in the back catalog about the labor radicalism in Hawaii, for example, to hear about more of that post-war period divide over the question of the role of radical and militant tendencies in the organized labor. Taft's very hardline conservatism was a harbinger of the future orientation of the Republican Party even before Goldwater in 1964, as was demonstrated in that 1952 battle with future President Eisenhower. Kelly, let's go to you first on this and talk about what the Taft-Hartley Act replaced in the Wagner Act. You can both weigh in on that, and then we'll talk about the context around the actual passage of Taft-Hartley. So, as I had said earlier, there were two attempted Great Depression era, New Deal era labor reforms under FDR's administration. We talked about the one from 1933 in our episode on the Toledo Auto Light strike in 1934, but it was then struck down by the Supreme Court. and this was replaced by the Wagner Act in 1935. So could you go over what the Taft-Hartley Act was trying to change that they did not like, that the conservatives did not like about the Wagner Act passed in 1935?
Sure. So as I was reading material to prep for this week, the thing that stuck out in my mind was thinking about the Wagner Act as a list of things that employers were prohibited from doing. So it restricted some of the activities of employers, while the Taft-Hartley Act restricted the activities of the employees themselves and the unions. And so the Wagner Act, which was passed first, of course, that forbade employees from five different labor practices. The first is that it forbade employers from interfering or with or restraining employees exercising their right to organize. So they couldn't stop unions attempting to form. They also couldn't attempt to dominate or influence a labor union. They couldn't refuse to bargain collectively. So they couldn't refuse to acknowledge the presence of the union. And they couldn't discourage or encourage union membership through any special conditions of employment. Unions existed, sort of thrived now that the Wagner Act was prohibiting certain employer activities. And it was essentially built upon the idea that employers had an inherent power. And so their activities had to be restricted in order to allow employees to have a fair shake. However, anti-union folks were unhappy with this because it did bind the hands of employers in so many ways. And so along comes the Taft-Hartley Act, which says, hey, if you are going to restrict certain employer activities, then we are going to restrict certain employee activities. And so the Taft-Hartley Act went about prohibiting certain union practices. And the practices that were no longer allowed under the Taft-Hartley Act include secondary boycotts, which is when a union induces employees to strike against their employer to get them to stop doing business with another employer. It stops sympathy strikes, which attempted to compel an employer which was not their own. It stopped jurisdictional strikes and boycotts, which is attempting to force an employer to give work to members of one particular union instead of another. And it outlawed the closed shop and union hiring halls that discriminated against non-union members. So this is where a lot of these right-to-work laws that we hear about now come about. They are allowed under the Taft-Hartley Act. As a sign of the times, it also included a provision that required union officers to file non-communist affidavits. And finally, it allowed the executive branch, the president, to forbid any strike that was not in the national interest and presented a national security threat. And so I know we'll talk about that more later, but it just goes to show you how far this act goes, that the president can stop a strike.
Yeah, there's kind of some theories, you know, who knows if it's true or not, that although it was vetoed by President Truman, that he didn't really maybe fight it as hard as he could have, or maybe he didn't fight to repeal it once Democrats regained control of Congress as hard as he could have, because he did like having that presidential authority to intervene. As you said, Kelly, we'll be talking about that more on an upcoming episode about a time that was used, you know, in the relative recent past.
I think it's also worth noting as we think about the passage of this law that the effect on unions was not like an accident, but Democrats at the time very much knew what the effect on unions was going to be. And 26 congressional Democrats even called this a new guarantee of industrial slavery. So sometimes we talk about like sort of accidents of history or unforeseen consequences, but it was very clear to all involved at the time that this would be fairly catastrophic to unions. And you know, it was passed anyway.
So, Rachel, could you talk a little bit more about what it was about the Wagner Act that the Taft-Hartley was a reaction to, not necessarily the specific details of the provisions that Kelly just talked about, but what had been the benefits of the Wagner Act and the other New Deal legislation on unions that the opponents of the New Deal, like Robert Taft, were attempting to correct or counter?
Right. So I'm taking some of the historical aspects from a democracyjournal.org magazine article called Fortress Unionism. So it goes over the history of kind of the background that led up to the passage of the Taft-Hartley Act. So in just the decade after the Wagner Act passed in 1935, union membership quadrupled from almost 3.6 million to more than 14.3 million workers. So that is over a third of the workforce. During this period, American labor dominated the daily life of much of the nation and drew the obsessive concern of politicians and the press. Even some southern states had union membership percentages in the high teens. These are numbers that would be among the highest in the nation today, but back then were among the smallest. In a six-month period in 1937 alone, the year of the great sit-down strike at General Motors in Flint, Michigan, the CIO signed up 2 million workers in a nation with a population of about 130 million, which is huge. And in 1946, all in all, about 10% of the entire American workforce withheld their labor. There were about 5,000 separate work stoppages involving about 4.6 million workers. This is over six times the number of workers involved in work stoppages over the entire eight-year period from 2005 to 2012, according to figures from the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service. This was at a time when the country had about one-third of the current non-agricultural workforce. So to imagine this kind of union militancy today is to imagine 14 million workers striking in a single year. So there was a lot of labor action happening. And so then
that's kind of the key context for the passage of Taft-Hartley, as we said, is this post-war strike wave that they wanted to shut down.
Right. So there was a huge backlash among employers and management that was trying to stop this huge labor wave from happening. So one major aspect that this Taft-Hartley Act opened up was the passage of right to work laws. They did attempt to make this a nationwide right to work law, but instead they modified it so it had to be passed within states. And there's a Jacobin magazine article from 2017 that really goes into the history of right to work laws. And it has a lot of excellent graphs and charts that really show the consequences to labor post the passage of the Taft-Hartley Act. So these right to work laws mean workers in a union shop are no longer required to pay dues to the union if they don't want to. So what this really did was weakened labor, and it's led to a depression of union membership and worker wages. So after the passage of the act, the right to work laws were passed quickly in states where labor was weakest, the southern states, where right to work really worked hand in hand with Jim Crow laws to keep wages down. Martin Luther King Jr. called it, quote, a whip to preserve the sharecropper wages. And then it quickly spread to the Midwest and Mountain West states over the next 2 to 3 decades. Idaho passed our right to work law in 1985. And ALEC and their allies have actually started to pass right to work laws in recent years, including Indiana and Michigan in 2012, Wisconsin in 2015, and West Virginia in 2016. So the big fallout from these right to work laws, union growth is slowed. There was a lot of talk and alarm raised that it would actually cut down union membership, which it has, but it really slowed down the growth more than anything. Also, the promised job growth from, quote, business friendly environments just don't materialize. There was a lot of talk that the heavy hand of labor getting weakened will increase job growth, increase just this really business-friendly environment where entrepreneurs and innovators can move in and change the landscape of business in a state where right-to-work laws are passed. However, this just doesn't materialize, and worse, right-to-work states are at a disadvantage in attracting higher-wage jobs. And also, there's a pronounced wage gap between right-to-work and non-right-to-work states, especially for workers in median-wage jobs. So in 2015, the median wage in Mississippi is at $14.49 versus DC, which is at $24.58. And this actually bears out even after other factors are controlled for. A quote from this article, In order to isolate the effect of right-to-work laws, economists at the Economic Policy Institute, this was a 2011 study by Elise Gould and Heidi Scherholz, and it was later updated by Gould and Will Kimball in 2015, controlled for an array of individual, such as education and employment status, and state variables, such as cost of living and unemployment rate. And they found that wages in right-to-work states are little over 3% lower than in non-right-to-work states. This is a $1,500 deficit for a typical full-time worker. That wage penalty is compounded by the fact that in the American context, much more than wages are at stake at the bargaining table. The compensation penalty, factoring lower rates of job-based health and retirement coverage, is even wider. So this has really put workers at a disadvantage and really cut down on both the wage and compensation packages that workers receive in their jobs.
Now, Rachel, one of the things that we have talked about this past year in 2020 in our examination of the Second Industrial Revolution and some of the changes to the U.S. economy from the previous sort of iterations of the U.S. economy was the rise of this, I mean, it subsequently became known as the middle class, but it's almost because it's a middle function within these very large corporations. These white-collar workers, even at an industrial corporation or a railroad company or something like that, who are not in the executive-level positions at the very top of the company. They're not in the C-suite. They're not owners of the company. They're not major shareholders of the company. Maybe they get a little bit of stock compensation, but it's a really nominal amount. But they're also not workers on the shop floor or the workers who are actually in the locomotive running the train. These are the middle management workers, which we've seen since the paperwork revolution that we talked about, the clerical revolution in that second industrial revolution, where you have the invention of cheap industrial processes for paper, you have the invention of typewriters, you have telegraphy, you then have telephones, etc. You have this growing number of workers who occupy these logistical positions, these paperwork positions that keep the company running, make a lot of decisions on how to execute certain things that are mandates from the top of the company and so forth. But they themselves are not making the overall decisions for the company. They themselves are occupying this sort of liminal position within the corporation, these middle manager positions, white collar positions in these companies. These became increasingly important. We've also seen a second surge in those positions in companies as the computer revolution, the technology, information technology revolution of what is sometimes the third industrial revolution in this country created an even bigger sort of not only role for, need for, but also the capacity and ability for these type of positions in a company. This is one of the sort of lesser sung features of American economic development that we've talked a lot about on this show. But they, because of this liminal position that they occupy within the companies, for a long time, there was kind of a debate as to what their alignment was or should be, ought to be, with regard to labor and management disputes. And one of the things that you're going to point out, Rachel, is the way in which the Taft-Hartley Act changed that role in a way that has kind of been forgotten, but is certainly important to the post-war course and trajectory of labor history in this country.
Yeah. So going back to the democracyjournal.org magazine article, they called it one of the least remembered provisions today, but one of the most consequential, which is the exclusion of foremen and supervisors from labor law. So at the time of Taft-Hartley's passage, the Foreman's Association of America was growing rapidly and had aligned itself with the CIO. So theoretically, frontline supervisors who did not set company policy were allowed to join forces with the unionized workers they ostensibly were bosses of. Employers viewed this practice as nothing short of, quote, industrial anarchy. So this banishment of the supervisors' organization flipped these mid-level employees back to the side of the employer And they really ensured that in subsequent decades, millions of employees in emerging white-collar segments of the economy would be statutorily denied the right to unionize. And I feel like we've definitely seen some of that pushback on white-collar unionization in the news of the Alphabet company, which is the parent company of Google, starting a workers' union. And a lot of people are saying, well, you're white-collar, you're well-paid, even though you don't have, you don't set company policy, you're basically in a cushy position and therefore don't really deserve the right to unionize. There's been a lot of that rhetoric floating around after that news came out.
And I think it's important to understand when we're having these discussions, if you go back to, you know, the original sort of Marxian analyses of companies, a lot of which he wrote and Engels wrote before the advent of a lot of these huge number of clerical jobs and paperwork jobs within these companies, is, you know, and especially in the U.S. context, there had been a tendency previously, and if you listen to our episode on prison labor and the origins of prison labor in the 19th century, you'll see why it was viewed this way, to view a lot of these foremen, floor managers, things like that, as being closer to sort of a slave overseer position and not really having anything in common with the workers. But that's not really accurate for a lot of the function of a lot of these logistical positions, paperwork positions, middle management positions. Again, they don't own more than a nominal amount of the company. If it's part of their compensation package, they have a little bit, but it's not, you know, huge amounts of shares of the company. It's certainly not a controlling or deciding stake in the company. They're not the bosses of the company overall. They have tremendous power within the supply chains to make certain, you know, decisions or potentially stop work and things like that if they wanted to. And they are also getting, you know, yes, they might be more well compensated in general than some of the lowest level people in the company, as Rachel was just alluding to. But if you look at the very strict Marxian definition of what is a wage, it is basically you take the amount of value that that person is generating for the company and you divide it into two parts. You have the wage part, which goes to the worker, and you have the profit part, which goes to the company. So if a middle, you know, if a middle management white collar position in the corporate office is generating, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars per hour for the company in value through their work, but they're only getting paid $100, even if it's a relatively well compensated position, they're still getting ripped off in the traditional sense that any worker is getting ripped off. They might be getting ripped off less, but they're still getting ripped off in terms of the how much value they're generating for the company with their work, even if it's not banging a hammer on a girder, as the joke goes. They are doing work with that paperwork, and it is generating value in some way for the company, and they are not getting anywhere close to an even or fair share of that value that they're generating per hour. One of the other things that you can sort of, we're not going to get into it too much today, but you can keep this in the back of your mind as you're thinking about this, is that although the Taft-Hartley Act, broadly speaking, discouraged and pushed back on having these sort of managerial unions, it was not true that every single industry lost those. Foremost among them, police in this country. One of the most powerful unions in the country, and for many reasons we've talked about on previous episodes of the show, not really consistent with the rest of the labor movement in their form, function, role within society, role within the economy, etc. But it is undeniable that having the alignment of supervisors' unions within the police and rank and file unions with the police has made police overall much, much more powerful actors in this country. Similarly, we're going to talk a little bit in our next regular episode, not bonus episode, about a particular strike involving the longshoremen, and the longshoremen, one of the more powerful unions in the country. Part of that power comes from the obvious sort of logistical choke point that they control, but some of that power, as we'll talk about, at least in the period that we're going to be talking about, one of the like major points of controversy was the fact that you did have some of these managerial positions that were quite well compensated and were unionized, and that further added to their power. So these are some themes to be thinking about as we're going forward. And by the way, just as a side digression, I'm really excited that we don't have to stick to the exact short time constraints that we used to have on the episodes, because this is the part that was getting left out on a lot of our episodes over the past year, was that we would talk about the historical development of the factors and then not get to talk about the and what does that mean from there, which we've just gone over now.
I think one thing we're thinking about here too is how the labor force has changed in the last 50 years with, you know, the advent of computers and more of those middle type management jobs and fewer people actually on the line building the car because robots are doing more and more of that work and there are more jobs in offices controlling the robots. And so I think that as we think about who is allowed to join a union, we should keep that in the context of like the changing labor market as well.
Absolutely. And if you were to envision an ideal scenario in which you had a powerful labor movement in this country that was demanding significant change and reorganization of the economy, and obviously this is a chicken and egg hypothetical to some degree, but if you were to imagine that, you would be imagining not just, you know, the warehouse workers at Amazon being unionized and the floor workers at Walmart being unionized. No, you would also be envisioning that the technology workers who control the cloud servers that these companies run on are unionized and can potentially disrupt those as part of a labor action. You're talking about the people who make the decision at Walmart or Amazon, make those little everyday decisions on, you know, shipping and logistics from their corporate office, not from the front line at the place, you know, the warehouse that the package is leaving or whatever. Those are the people that have immense control over the bottlenecks in the U.S. economy that gives them leverage to extract concessions. Same thing if we're talking about something like a union at Alphabet, aka Google, is that if you have some of these technology workers, which are increasingly these white collar jobs, these kind of liminal positions within these corporations, are an increasingly large share of these companies, which the companies, yes, the bulk of their value is being generated by the service workers that work at the lowest level or by the manufacturing workers if it's that type of company. But a lot of this is also being driven by, determined by, and controlled by those liminal white collar so-called middle class workers who, again, aren't really a middle class. If you want to get really strict and technical, they aren't a middle class because they don't own the capital. They work for a wage. It's called a salary in their case, but it is functionally still a wage, even if it's not divided by hourly, which is something we could get into on another episode, I guess, as well. Anyway, Rachel, did you have any thoughts on this?
I'm just really excited to see what the Alphabet Workers Union can accomplish. I think one super important thing to note is that they are also including independent contractors, which is huge because that is such a huge part of their labor force, as well as the labor force of a lot of these tech companies, which has been used in the past to really kind of kneecap labor power and organizing power. Also, something else I wanted to point out is that in addition to the Alphabet workers speaking out against what their company is doing and the policy that they have really no say in, Amazon Web Services workers have been speaking out against the hosting of some websites. I'm sure y'all know that Parler's in the news lately. And actually, a whole bunch of Amazon Web Service workers did circulate a petition asking for Amazon Web Services to stop hosting Parler. So that's something else that's really important. Even though these workers don't really get to set the policy that their parent companies are enacting, they are starting to speak out and organize to try to help democratize the workplace, which is something that we definitely need. And that's something that labor is really helpful in providing for workers.
I'll go back to you now, Kelly, to talk more about the current context. Where are we at in terms of the modern state of the Taft-Hartley Act and potential reforms that pro-labor people are pushing for? Obviously, what Taft-Hartley replaced was not perfect either, so it's not just a question of rolling it back to that, but there are some things that we could certainly do that would get us into a much better position and a much fairer and equitable position.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that is very obvious reading about and discussing this is that the Taft-Hartley Act still very much dictates how unions and their employers operate today. It is still very much a hindrance to the pro-labor, pro-union forces. And so during the 2020 primaries, both Senator Warren and Senator Sanders specifically called out for repeals of certain sections of the act. They both wanted to get rid of the right to work laws, as well as the rule that allows employers to have quote unquote captive audiences and share their, you know, anti-union rhetoric at places where employees are required to be. And they both endorse the right to restore secondary boycotts, which is, like we mentioned, boycotting to get your employer to stop doing business with another employer. And so there are certain sections of the act that are that the more progressive wing of the Democratic Party would like to repeal. But many union strategists say that doesn't even go far enough, and we need to repeal the entire act. Senator Sanders' legislation, which he's titled the Workplace Democracy Act, is the current gold standard in legislation to protect unions. It hasn't been passed, but his ideas are, he's written down in this Workplace Democracy Act, but even that doesn't totally repeal the Taft-Hartley Act, but does repeal these pieces of it that we've mentioned. One difference that's worth noting between Warren and Sanders in the 2020 primary election was that Warren wants to limit the definition of supervisor, essentially. So when we talk about prohibiting the unionization of supervisor, of course, has to be defined for that in order for that to be enforced. And Warren wanted to update and change that definition, while Sanders wanted to eliminate that entirely and allow supervisors to unionize without hindrance.
All right. Well, as always, our notes and links will be up at arsenalfordemocracy.com in a PDF with this episode, as we do for every episode. Kelly, thank you so much for being on this week to talk about the Taft-Hartley Act.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's always fun to talk to you both.
And Rachel, thank you for being here as well.
Always a pleasure. Glad to be back after our brief holiday hiatus.
And again, as a reminder for folks, we've been unlocking our upcoming first several episodes on our Patreon. It's up at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy. If you want to subscribe, it's only $5 a month, and you'll get an additional episode each week. A lot of them are going to have guest episodes and really interesting discussions. Sometimes we'll have book reviews and things like that as well. So we would really encourage folks, if you like the show in general, please do subscribe over there. We're going to have a lot of great stuff for you this year. So thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon.